This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author Anne Drone talks about her new book, They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars.
This may be one of the great anti-war books of our decade. Read it and weep.
We'll hear excerpts from a talk by Glenn Ford at the Black Agenda Report's 7th anniversary gathering at Harlem's Riverside Church.
Ford discusses the black misleadership class, focusing on a new hero of the chattering classes, Cory Booker.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
What are the true costs of war in Afghanistan? Our guest, author Anne Jones, has written a profoundly important book titled They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars. It chronicles a world mostly hidden from the general public. Anne Jones has spent nearly a decade working with Afghan civilians and writing about the effects of war on their lives. In the last couple of years, she has focused on the human toll on and off the battlefield as U.S. soldiers return from war zones with permanent mental damage, missing limbs, or as quadruple amputees. Anne is a journalist, photographer, and the author of 9 books of nonfiction. She has written extensively about violence against women. Anne Jones, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Anne Jones, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Your book, They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story, is really quite something like no other modern anti-war book, in my opinion. You spent 2 years interviewing hundreds of people, soldiers and their families, and you present snapshots of these soldiers and their families. And you say that war is not natural. The Iraq war, the Afghanistan war were not needed. They never should have been fought. And I wanted to talk to you about the soldiers that you learned about during those two wars. And I wondered whether you might read from the introduction to the book, starting with contrary to common opinion in the United States.
All right. Contrary to common opinion in the United States, war is not inevitable, nor has it always been with us. War is a human invention, an organized, deliberate action of an antisocial kind, and in the long span of human life on Earth, a fairly recent one. For more than 99% of the time that humans have lived on this planet, most of them have never made war. Many languages don't even have a word for it. Turn off CNN and read anthropology. You'll see. What's more, war is obsolete. Most nations don't make war anymore, except when coerced by the United States to join some spurious coalition. The Earth is so small, and our time here so short. No other nation on the planet makes war as often, as long, as forcefully, as expensively, as destructively, as wastefully, as senselessly, or as unsuccessfully as the United States. No other nation makes war its business.
Well, I just want to say, this is Michael Ratner. I hadn't read that yet. That's really powerful. I mean, that says everything that our lives, I think, have been dedicated to for since we've been born almost. But fantastic. Really amazing.
Well, it's very curious to me that people are struck by that passage as though it's something new, you know, because I live in Norway, where, of course, peace is taken for granted, as it is in Europe. And the United States looks crazed the way we send our forces all over the world and, you know, are always looking for a fight.
Might you finish up the introduction and read to us that last short paragraph?
This book, then, is not about war itself, nor even about soldiers, as they are trained to see themselves, and we, in turn, are taught to see and support them. It is about the damage done to soldiers, their families, their communities, and the rest of us, who for another half century at least will pay for their care, their artificial limbs, their medications, their benefits, their funerals, and the havoc they dutifully wrought under orders around the world.
Anne Jones, you write about a certain division of the Army called the Department of Mortuary Affairs, something that I had never heard of. I think something that people who are in it don't like to talk about much. But you went out and you talked to them. You talked to Vicki Slater and Jessica Godell, who do mortuary affairs work. And I wondered whether you could talk to us about that.
Well, every unit of any size has a special unit within it that does mortuary affairs, because all combat units are losing soldiers all the time, and even soldiers who never leave base may be victims of this war, suicides, for example. There are a lot of them. And the job of the soldiers assigned to mortuary affairs is to protect the other soldiers from knowledge of those deaths as much as possible. And they become extremely isolated themselves. No other soldiers want to talk to them, knowing what their job is. And you can imagine what this job is like. Consider that the people who are doing it are very often kids just out of high school, and their job is to go out and retrieve the pieces of soldiers who very often in Afghanistan have literally been blown to pieces, and bring those body parts and remains back to the base, to their little secret place within the base, and try to match up body parts so that they can put them in what are called transfer cases, to transfer them home to the mortuary at Dover, Delaware, where they're repackaged and gussied up and put in proper coffins to be sent on to the families for burial. It's about the grimmest job you could imagine in the world.
You write about the wounded in your book, They Were Soldiers. You have one chapter called Salvage, the Wounded, and I wondered whether you could read to us from page 44, the second paragraph.
By early 2012, 3,000 soldiers had been killed by IEDs in Iraq and Afghanistan, and 31,394 wounded. Among the wounded were more than 1,800 soldiers with severe damage to their genitals. Asking the Department of Defense for an update on the statistics in July 2013, I was told I would have to file a formal request under the Freedom of Information Act. Evidently, the new numbers are high enough to be made hard to get. It's safe to say they can no longer convincingly be described as small. It's not a huge number of people, the urological surgeon at Bagram Base says, speaking of the surgeries he has performed himself. But the severity of the injuries and the possibility of complications down the road, that weighs heavily. The kind of injuries you don't have any idea of the devastation until you see it up close. This has been eye-opening. It's given me a new understanding of the costs of armed conflict. Even being in the military, I didn't know. An ER nurse, an Army major on her second deployment at Bagram, tells me that catastrophic cases pass through the ER 4 days out of seven, and quadruple amputees often. She says, I've taken care of 20 or 30 of them myself. She has lost count. I ask how she would describe the typical case she sees in the ER. She replies, amputees up to the waist, no arms, no legs, no genitals, age 21 or 22. We cry.
And you yourself went to Germany. There's a a military hospital that the United States runs there, has run for quite a while in Landstuhl, Germany. And that's where they take these wounded soldiers. You write that since the beginning of America's global war on terrorism, Landstuhl has treated approximately 60,000 patients. And I wanted to ask you if you would read it to us about that on page 57.
Yes. The U.S. military liberated the town of Landstuhl, Germany, in 1945. 6 years later, in 1951, already looking forward to the next war, it started building a 1,000-bed hospital to serve U.S. personnel in Europe and farther afield. Landstuhl Post became a permanent U.S. military installation. In 2003, not long after George W. Bush launched his war on Iraq, the hospital was officially renamed Landstuhl Regional Medical Center and became the primary medical treatment center for casualties of U.S. operations within Europe, Southwest Asia, and the Middle East. It actually covers an enormous part of the world, and soldiers come in from everywhere. They're Landstuhl is very close to Ramstein Air Base in Germany. There are special air ambulance services that go out from there to Africa, to Asia, to pick up even individual casualties. The individuals are often members of the CIA or private contractors or military special ops people. But that operation in Germany, part of this whole incredible war-making machine, is set up to go and retrieve what's called, in military terms, the fallen, wherever they may fall in the world, and speed them back to Landstuhl. I came, for the purposes of writing this book, I came from, with the wounded, from forward operating bases in Afghanistan, to Bagram Air Base, the principal base there, which is the highest level of trauma hospital in the field there. And then the soldiers, the critically injured soldiers, are transported from there as quickly as possible to Landstuhl, and then on from Landstuhl to the U.S., to military hospitals here. And they're being treated for their catastrophic injuries all the way with repeated surgical operations in all of those hospitals and attended by critical care medical teams, doctor, nurse, respiratory therapist, every step of the way on the medevac planes that carry them from hospital to hospital on the way home.
And Anne, they're also attended by representatives of God. You call them the God Squad. And you had a most remarkable exchange with one of these men, a U.S. Army major. And I wanted to ask you if you would please read to us from page 65 about your encounter with one of these God Squad representatives.
"Where was God?" says a U.S. Army major who serves as a chaplain at Larmsey, that's Landstuhl. "We are sitting together in a hospital cafeteria talking about the soldiers dependent upon him for spiritual care and perhaps absolution. He is one of an army within the army, a God Squad of evangelicals who first swarmed into the military during and after the war in Vietnam, replacing many Christian chaplains who had resigned as a matter of conscience. The military welcomed the newly enthusiastic chaplains who helped to transform it into an aggressive outfit of conservative Christian Republican soldiers. Military bookstores stock racks of evangelical literature, along with standard texts of popular right-wing conspiracy theories, anti-Hillary and anti-Obama screeds, and the complete works of Ayn Rand. The very presence of so many evangelicals within the military seems to confer a kind of blessing on the use of force, creating the widespread impression among Americans that U.S. military power is always good, and perhaps, as historian Andrew J. Basevich has put it, even a necessary adjunct to the accomplishment of Christ's saving mission. Without the evangelicals in and out of the military, it would be hard, perhaps impossible, even in feisty America, to stir up enough enthusiasm for war. But what message, I wonder, might an evangelical chaplain deliver to terribly damaged troops who have surrendered their future to the Department of Defense? That's what they ask, you know, the chaplain tells me. First, they want to know if their buddies are okay, and then that is the next question. Where was God when this terrible thing happened to my friend or happened to me? Did they expect God to show up, I ask? They're very young, you know, the chaplain says, and very susceptible to disillusionment. They've grown up with movies and TV programs about good guys and bad guys in conflicts where simple solutions are reached in half an hour. The faith they profess is very naive. It leaves them more susceptible to moral injury. They face the realization that the good guy doesn't always win. God does not always intervene.
The military suicides, the huge number of sexual assaults, the big pharma, and the collaboration with giving these guys opium drugs. Those are really interesting parts of your book, I thought. And I wanted to first ask you about this phenomena of huge number of military suicides.
Yes, well, the suicides have been increasing year by year, as we know. Many of those suicides take place in the field. There have been a number documented that have been the result of hazing and those sexual assaults, but a great many more take place here at home when soldiers return and find that they cannot live with themselves. I describe one of those suicides at some length in my book, the story that was told to me by the parents of this young man who have become themselves advocates for veterans. And the story that family told me, I heard from many others, that a soldier returns, seems to be doing well, just fine, and within some months, perhaps even as long as a year, but then begins to crumble. We see typical behaviors that we've seen from veterans in other wars, abuse of substances, of drugs and alcohol, risky behavior, reckless driving, getting into fights, that kind of thing. And finally, then, this suicidality. And very often, what these soldiers have to say is that they cannot tolerate what they did. The young man whose story I tell was commanded by a senior officer to shoot two Iraqi prisoners in custody. And he apparently did that. And that is the war crime that he could not live with. And he kept saying that he was just a murderer. And his family, which rallied to try to get help from him, tried desperately to get help for him from the VA and from private psychiatrists, psychologists. The VA was absolutely not helpful. They identified his drinking as his problem, and they said they couldn't do anything for him until he stopped drinking. And, of course, while they searched for help for him, he did succeed in taking his own life. And that's a very common story. I think even more troubling now is the number of soldiers and ex-soldiers who are not really counted in the statistics, who are taking their lives apparently under the influence of opioid painkillers that have been pushed upon them by Big Pharma, which succeeded in getting Congress to pass legislation that compels the VA to prescribe opioid painkillers for any soldier complaining of pain, and every soldier complains of bodily pains. So they're handing out these drugs, which were billed as having absolutely no side effects, and now, of course, have been to be highly addictive, particularly in young people, and to be heavily implicated in suicide. So the rate at which soldiers under treatment in the VA are taking their lives is what should be a national scandal. A subcommittee of the Senate Finance Committee started looking into the relationship between Big Pharma and front organizations that it had set up, consisting of so-called doctors and psychiatrists who would testify before Congress to the great benefits of these painkillers and the need for these painkillers. Clearly, this was a very shady kind of relationship between these so-called scientific foundations that were funded almost entirely by the big pharma organizations. But when the congressional committee started supposedly investigating this by subpoenaing documents from those foundations about a year and a half ago, that imposed a silence upon the whole discussion. So I've been trying ever since then to get more information, but now the excuse is we cannot discuss this because it's under investigation. So what should be a national scandal has been put under wraps by this, I would use the word collusion, between the investigators and the investigated.
And the irony you mentioned is that here these soldiers are over in Afghanistan uprooting poppy plants, and they get home and they get hooked on these opiums derived from poppies, or at least synthetically manufactured opiates.
Synthetically manufactured right here,
yeah. We're talking about Vicodin, Oxycontin, stuff's extremely powerful and addictive. I wanted to also ask you, this is a story that is finally starting to get some play, and that's the huge amount of sexual assaults in the Army, not only upon women, who are particularly vulnerable in this man's army, but among men.
Yes, the rate, it's very, very difficult to get any kind of accurate statistics on this because most victims of sexual assault don't report it, since they have to report to the chain of command, and usually the assailant is either somewhere in that chain of command or looked upon with favor by the chain of command. So the victims very often wind up being persecuted. Many of them are given other than honorable discharges for psychiatric reasons and so on. So their careers, male or female, are pretty well ended if they complain. But it's estimated that one in three women soldiers have been the victim of sexual assault, though in fact the number of male soldiers victimized is even greater. The percentage is less, but the number is greater because men still represent 85% of the personnel in the military. And men are even less likely to report than women for the same reason.
We're speaking with Ann Jones, the author of They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, the Untold Story. Ann, talk to us about who joins the military and why do they join?
I will. I would just like to say, though, if I may, that right now is a very important time in considering this matter of sexual assault because Congress is supposed to vote upon the military appropriations for the following year very shortly. Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, is leading the campaign to attach an amendment to that budgetary appropriation that would remove the prosecution, the reporting and the decisions about prosecution and the prosecution itself from the chain of command and place it in the hands of specially trained military and civilian legal units that would address the whole problem of sexual assault. And the military, the Pentagon, has taken a very strong stand against this, including the Secretary of Defense, on the very strange grounds that if this is taken out of the hands of the command, they cannot maintain good order. Well, they're clearly not maintaining good order at the moment. So this proposal is a very sane one. It is the common practice in many of our NATO allies and some of the most progressive militaries in the world, and certainly should be our practice. So it's important that people right now let their representatives in Congress know how they want them to vote on this matter. They should vote with Senator Gillibrand.
You visited these people, and you know quite a lot about them. And who is it that joins the modern American military, and why do they do it?
Well, this, I think, should be another national scandal. It's kids, for the most part, and it's kids from poor families, often dysfunctional or violent families. It's kids from small towns, mainly in the South and the Rust Belt and urban centers, who see very little, if any, opportunity for their ambitions and their idealism in their home communities. And to them, the opportunity to join the military is just that, an opportunity, maybe the only way they can see to get up and out of the neighborhood where they live or the small town where they live. But it's in these very neighborhoods, in these schools, that the Pentagon finances junior ROTC programs, where kids are recruited into ROTC at the age of 14 and trained up by taking these courses in their schools to be members of the military. And they usually are persuaded to enlist even before graduation. If you go to any Veterans Day parade in the U.S. these days, you'll find it consists mostly of high school marching bands and junior ROTC kids, 14, 15, 16 years old, marching along, and they will soon be America's armies for its next needless wars.
Ann Jones, author of They Were Soldiers. You have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Well, I wish Americans would get back the kind of interest in what happens to our military that we had in the old days when we had conscription after the war in Vietnam, for example, and where citizens were truly involved in decisions about going to war, the conduct of war, and were even able to help to influence to stop wars in ways we don't seem to find it possible to do anymore. But I think it's time for citizens to quit looking the other way and to get up off the couch and start marching.
Well, I can tell our listeners that there's no more profound book written in modern times about the consequence of Americans' imperial wars. They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story by Ann Jones. Ann, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Come and listen to my story. Come and listen to my song. I'll tell you of a hero who now is dead and gone. I'll tell you of a young boy whose age was 19. He was the bravest Union man that I have ever seen. Harry Sims, he was a pal of mine. We labored side by side, expecting to be shot on sight or taken for a ride by some dirty coal operator gun thug that roamed from town to town to shoot and kill our Union men wherever they may be found.
We go now to hear Glenn Ford speaking at the Black Agenda Report 7th Anniversary Gathering in October 2013 at Harlem's Riverside Church. The theme of the event was The Black Misleadership Class versus the Movement and Its Legacy. Ford gives a strong criticism of newly elected New Jersey Senator Cory Booker as the essence of black misleadership, demonstrating that Booker has many ties to corporate America.
To begin this program, which is put together around the theme of the Black Misleadership Class, I think that two words would suffice to introduce the subject of Black Misleadership Class. And those words are Cory Booker, whose name is, of course, on everyone's lips. Just this week, of course, Cory Booker was elected, or became the senator-elect from New Jersey. Last night, I was flipping around through the channels, and I stumbled, totally by mistake, of course, stumbled upon Fox TV. And I saw that the crew was busy trying to explain how Cory Booker was such a liberal tax and spend politician who would favor urban areas, meaning black, over suburban areas of New Jersey, meaning white. And that is just so far from the truth, it is laughable, because Cory Booker is the politician who was bought and paid for by the same institutions, the same money bags that are just as white and far to the right as Fox News itself. In point of historical fact, Booker's political career was birthed in the womb of the right-wing Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you don't get any more reactionary than that. The Bradley Foundation was so far to the right and so good at doing far-right things that it was dubbed by President Bush his favorite foundation. And he wasn't kidding about that. They did him some great service. They contributed to two of his most important domestic policies. One of them was called the Faith-Based Initiative, which was essentially a scheme designed to bribe a whole class of black preachers. And black preachers are, of course, a very important component of the black misleadership class, as Dr. West would explain if he hadn't had this personal tragedy. Bush's faith-based initiative had black preachers lined up, literally thousands of them, to get a federal gift. And in return, those preachers would either become Republicans or endorse Republican policies. That was the product of the Bradley Foundation and the think tanks that it funds. The other gift that the Bradley Foundation gave to the Bush administration was the campaign for private school vouchers. And that campaign was very quickly expanded into an all-out push for charter schools, which did even more widespread destruction. And that is the point where Cory Booker comes in. Cory Booker had just turned 30, and he was in his first year of his first term in the Newark City Council, where, by the way, and I used to cover the Newark City Council for a small black newspaper that I helped found, and nobody on the city council paid much attention to Cory Booker. He was there at the first meeting, the founding gathering, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. under the auspices of the Bradley Foundation for a front group that they had specifically formed in order to try and create the impression that there was a movement out there among black folks for private school vouchers. Now, the reality was that private school vouchers had never been an issue in the black community. If people were familiar at all with private school vouchers, it was in the context of them being used in order to fund segregation academies in the Deep South during the time of massive resistance. But the Bradley Foundation reasoned that with their millions and millions of dollars, they could create a movement or the semblance of one out of a thin air. All they had to do was attract a gaggle of hustlers and scoundrels, black hustlers and scoundrels, and call them the thinkers and movers and shakers of a new movement, and it would be so. And all they had to do was tell the corporate media that this was a legitimate movement of black people, and they would cover it that way. And Cory Booker was at that first meeting of this Black Alliance of for Educational Options in 1998. Also on hand was Floyd Flake. He was the congressman from Queens who, before he resigned, was the only member of the Congressional Black Caucus who ever supported school vouchers. Floyd Flake went on to become an important cog in the wheel of the Manhattan Institute. All of you are familiar with that right-wing outfit, and to make millions as a practitioner of charter schools. Flake and Booker are part of a black misleadership class, however, one that is totally bought and paid for, created out of whole cloth by the corporate world. 3 years later, after Cory got his real political beginnings, after he put together the source of his funding, he made his first run for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That was in 2002. He was backed with millions of dollars in campaign funds from that same universe of right-wingers that he had met through the Bradley Foundation. Even the right-wing columnist George F. Will came to Newark to support Cory Booker. This is how Cory Booker was set on the path to becoming a major black political figure as a wholly owned subsidiary of the most reactionary forces in the United States, as a pure servant of corporate power. And that year was 2002. That's when we first called attention at Black Commentator. Black Commentator was the predecessor to Black Agenda Report, and that's where the core of the Black Agenda Report team came together. And back in 2002, we were the first to call attention to the great danger that was represented not just by Cory Booker, but to all of these newly empowered hustlers and scoundrels who were being funded by the corporate world. That was the first issue, in fact, of the Black Commentator, the cover story for that first issue. It was called Fruit of the Poison Tree. The core team of Black Agenda Report has actually been documenting the rise of this new cohort of black corporate politicians for more than a decade, not just the 7 years that we're celebrating tonight of Black Agenda Report. The black misleadership class is nothing new. It did not begin in 1998 or in 2002 or even with this surge of corporate funding. It has always been there. It has existed in some form as long as there has been a black America. It is a class that sees its own personal, financial, and social interests as being synonymous with the progress of black people as a whole. This class does not seek transformation of society. It seeks only their own elevation within the existing structures. the rest of Black America, as far as they are concerned, is supposed to applaud their individual success. And we're also supposed to call that Black progress, no matter what is actually happening to the masses of Black people at the bottom. It is the politics of putting Black faces in high places, and to hell with those of us stuck at the bottom, or those of us who are below the bottom in the U.S. prison gulag. This Black misleadership class has always been among us, and it is the tension between these representationists, these who see only the goal of being represented, that is, having a few Black folks in business and in motion pictures, and maybe one day, now is the day, in the White House, but do not see the need for a transformation of society. What's new is the massive influx of national corporate money to Black Democrats. To Black Democrats. That is the transformation that occurred at the turn of the 21st century, and resulting in not just Cory Booker's candidacy, but others as well. It all begins in 2002 with Cory Booker's first campaign for mayor and the corporate-funded unseating of Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta and of Earl Hilliard in Alabama. These campaigns were funded by the same people that put Cory Booker up for office the first time. Corporate money transformed the Black electoral politics game, just as corporate money subverted the old line Black civic and civil rights organizations and made them into willing partners with the very same Wall Street banks that were, back in 2002, beginning to target every Black neighborhood in the nation with subprime mortgages. That is when that offensive began as well. Corporate America begins the 21st century with a massive money offensive in Black America, and they were successful beyond their wildest dreams. They knew that they had a future star in Cory Booker, and they're so happy today. They're celebrating. Their boy is going to the Senate. But back in 2002, they were also vetting another and much more talented and much more promising front man for Capitol. And his name was Barack Obama. He was beginning his campaign for the Senate from Illinois. We at Black Agenda Report, or rather at Black Commentator when the team was there, we confronted Obama for a solid month in June of 2003, Bruce Dixon and I. We had an intense back-and-forth exchange with Brother Obama, which you can still read in the pages of the Black Commentator. We knew that Obama was a nightmare that was about to happen, but we did let him slide. We hoped that we could somehow avoid denouncing this up-and-coming young man that so many people found so attractive. But of course, it didn't work that way. We couldn't avoid him for long. It was Barack Obama who wound up moving forward and astonishingly, in astonishing speed, Cory Booker's and the Bradley Foundation's agenda on the privatization of public schools. And one of Obama's first acts was to expand the faith-based initiatives. So we have the Bradley Foundation's initiative living on with Obama, just as the Heritage Foundation's legacy lives on in Obamacare. Cory Booker has gone on to climb into bed with every money bag in the Silicon Valley. But Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief of global capitalism, the imperial maestro with a kill list that has everybody's name and everybody's address on it, along with all of your social and political networks and friends. And all of this has been done with a Black face. The transformation in Black politics over the last 10 years has been staggering. It has been absolutely breathtaking. In 2002, when George Bush asked the U.S. Congress for war powers in order to attack Iraq, only 4 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor. Our team at the Black Commentator called these 4 people the 4 eunuchs of war. Now fast forward just 9 years to 2011, in the age of Obama, fully half of the Congressional Black Caucus, 20 members, voted against a resolution that would have halted the U.S. bombing of an African nation, Libya. This is an outcome that would have been unthinkable under George Bush just a few years before. It was even more grotesque when it's remembered that while these 20 Black members of Congress were voting to continue bombing Libya, President Obama's jihadist rebel friends were carrying out a race war on the ground in Libya, purging the country of Black Libyans and African migrants and massacring them by the thousands. But that didn't change the minds of half of the Congressional Black Caucus. Only a decade earlier, in 2003, just 6 weeks before the Iraq war began, the Zogby poll did a survey that found that only 21% of Blacks supported an attack on Iraq. Huge majorities at the same time of white men were for the war, and majorities of white women and nearly half of Hispanics were also for a war against Iraq. But when the Zogby poll asked the question, would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of Iraqi civilians, only 7% of Blacks said yes. And that was a reaffirmation of what pollsters had found consistently ever since Blacks have been included in the polling process. They have found that African Americans are the group most consistently opposed to U.S. military adventures abroad. And that is because, historically, we have not trusted the motives of the United States. And we never have. That is, until a Black man came to sit in the White House. And suddenly, those motives were seen as benign. Now, fast forward again to September of this year. For the first time in history, more Blacks said they were in favor of war than whites did. This has never happened before. 40% of Blacks surveyed by the ABC Washington Post poll said they were in favor of a military strike against Syria. Only 38% of whites said so, and only 31% of Hispanics were in favor. The question then raised is this a repudiation by a sizable proportion of Black folks of the historical Black consensus on peace and on social justice? I don't think that it is a repudiation, but right now we can't prove whether it is or not. What is clear is that the age of Obama is offering up the worst role models in Black American history, and a Black political class that is quite willing to consign the Black consensus on peace to the dustbin of history in order to defend a Black presence in the highest office in the land. So go bomb the Libyans and go bomb the Syrians. We got a Black man in the White House. What does it matter? A significant proportion of the Black population is willing to go along with almost any program as long as they feel that they are acting or expressing opinions that are in defense of Obama. I'm going to leave you with one more horrific factoid. Fully 1/3 of the Black caucus recently voted to maintain the NSA's spying program on all Americans. And to think, one-third of the caucus, people who are representing black communities that are suffering mass incarceration and have been suffering mass incarceration for the last 40 years. And we understand that the beginning of the process of mass incarceration is hyper-surveillance of the black community. And yet this one-third of the black caucus votes for hyper-surveillance of all Americans. This is a monstrous deformity of black politics, and it has occurred over just the last 10 years. It's rooted in the huge onslaught of corporate money into black democratic politics and in the suborning by corporations of traditional black organizations. There is no movement to act as a countervailing force to the power of capital. And when there is no mass movement, the self-serving black misleadership class becomes even more influential internally in black America. Black Agenda Report exists to play a role in the rebuilding of a mass black movement. And if there is no rebuilding of a mass black movement, there is little hope of any effective progressive resistance to the rule of Wall Street and its servants in government and for peace. Some of you may say, Glenn, why all this lamentation? I thought this was supposed to be a celebration of Black Agenda's 7th anniversary, and you ain't smiled yet. But I think that we are celebrating. We're celebrating the fact that we are still here fighting the power every day. And that more and more people of all races are recognizing the real dimensions of the crisis and the character and nature of the crisis. We're celebrating the fact that there still exists a critical mass of people who are struggling to reestablish and repair the black historical consensus for social justice and peace. And some of the most outstanding personalities in that struggle are right here with us tonight. We promised you a productive and worthwhile evening. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford speaking at the Black Agenda Report 7th Anniversary of Riverside Church. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.